Now, the Success Journal. Here's Chris Whitting.
And welcome to Success Journal podcast number 22. Coming up on this episode, are you good at saying no to people? We share two brain hacks that will make you better at telling others no when you don't want to do something. Then, millions of Americans aren't getting the sleep they need to succeed. A top sleep doc reveals how bad it is and gives tips to help you sleep better starting tonight.
If you need 7 hours of sleep, you do not adapt to 5 or 6 hours of sleep per night, and you cannot catch up fully over the course of a single weekend.
And a toy maker invents a doll for boys and earns a handsome figure. Plus, a look at future technology and why we should be optimistic about what's ahead.
I'm off the chart optimistic, and a lot of my optimism comes from history. The beauty of technology is that it keeps increasing our choices without taking away very many of the old ones.
And a man bottles a new soft drink and refreshes his bank account. Success Journal starts right now. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/successjournal. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
The Success Journal Podcast. Informative advice from leading experts. Helpful, practical tips to enhance your career, your income, and your personal freedom. The Success Journal Podcast with Chris Whitting.
Hello and welcome. Well, the other day, I heard from an old friend I used to work with decades ago. He was in the area with his lady friend for a short vacation, and he wanted to say hello. Well, long story short, we met up for a drink, and our conversation picked right up where we'd left off the last time. We had a great time getting caught up on everything, and we promised not to let so many years go by next time. So why do I share this story? I'm guessing you have an old friend or two you haven't spoken with in a long time, maybe in a very long time, and they might love to hear from you. So make that connection. I promise it'll make your life better, and it will make your life more successful. First up on today's podcast, many of us find it hard to say no when people ask us for help. Here are two things you need to understand from Susan Newman, author of The Book of No. When people ask you to do something, they're focused on the task at hand. And when you say no, they don't sit and dwell on how you let them down. They move on to find someone else to fix the bookcase or drive the carpool. People are far more understanding than we realize. So keep this in mind when you need to say no. And secondly, when you need to say no, you're not required to give an explanation. In fact, explaining can get you into trouble. Just a polite, "No, I can't help you out with that this time." That's all you need. And don't fret over the consequences. You won't be missed as much as you think. Well, before our first interview today with a top sleep doctor, it's time for a 60-second success journal about a man who bottles a tasty soft drink and refreshes his bank account. Claude Hatcher was fresh out of school and hatched a way to make money. He began buying soft drinks from a local bottler to sell to nearby customers. But when the bottling company discovered the scheme, they popped their tops and canceled the deal. With nothing to sell, the young man's profit went flat. Months of work went right down the drain. But Claude was a real fighter. He went to his kitchen and taste-tested till he came up with his own soft drink recipe. It was a ginger ale that customers loved. Next, he created a cola that was even more popular. You've probably had Claude's cola drink. Its name? Royal Crown. RC Cola is still a top seller. Our guest is Dr. W. David Brown. He's a sleep psychologist at Children's Medical Center in Dallas and co-author of Sleeping Your Way to the Top: How to Get the Sleep You Need to Succeed. Well, at one time or another, we've all had the idea that sleep is a waste of time. It's keeping us from being more productive. But, Doctor, you say the opposite, that our success in life is very dependent on getting enough sleep.
And I think the evidence for that is overwhelming now. Most of us want to be short sleeper wannabes. I mean, there are natural short sleepers in this world, but the vast majority of us need much more sleep than we're actually getting. You know, it was really Thomas Edison, inventor of the electric light bulb, who said that sleep was a criminal waste of time and a heritage from our cave days. And he scoffed at the idea of sleep, was trying to convince all of his employees to stop sleeping. And the electric light bulb itself now extended the day into the night so that we could work longer hours and even 24 hours a day with the use of his invention. And I think this attitude just sort of evolved that we need to be productive, that we're not biologic organisms, so we don't obey the same rules of nature, and we can do without sleep. But now the pendulum has swung back, and we cannot do without sleep. And even not enough sleep is causing significant impairment in us.
How does not getting enough sleep affect our productivity? Is that something that really can be measured?
It can be measured in a number of ways. First off, if you are not getting enough sleep on a chronic basis, let's say you need 7 hours of sleep, you get 5 hours of sleep tonight, you'll function well tomorrow. But let's say you don't get but 5 hours for the next five nights, you will have missed 10 hours of sleep, even though you're sleeping every single night. So this is called chronic partial sleep deprivation, and that has negative effects on us. It affects our attention, our concentration, our memory, our creativity. It increases risk-taking behavior. There's absenteeism. Having an insomnia complaint is the second best predictor of absenteeism from work. We even use the term now, though, called presenteeism. These are employees that show up to work, but they're not all there. They're sluggish. They can't function clearly. They're slow at what they do, and they actually get less work accomplished, even though they may spend more time at their job. David Dengis at the University of Pennsylvania studied a group of young men. One group didn't sleep at all for one or two nights. The other group slept 4 hours, 6 hours, or 8 hours. And any group at less than 8 hours, over the course of 2 weeks, showed impairment levels of somebody who hadn't slept at all for one or two nights. And yet he asked them, he said, "How do you think you're doing?" And the people that didn't sleep at all knew they were doing awful, but everybody else says, "I'm doing fine, I'm doing great." Subjectively, we fool ourselves. We say we're doing fine when in fact the objective data is we've got problems.
Many people seem to get less than the optimal amount of sleep by choice. Is that an issue of time management, or why is that?
Well, I'm hoping part of this is this belief that I don't need as much sleep, that I can adapt to this. And I can tell you, we do not adapt. If you need 7 hours of sleep, you do not adapt to 5 or 6 hours of sleep per night. And you cannot catch up fully over the course of a single weekend. And so I think many people choose not to sleep. And, you know, they don't realize that they are impaired because we tend to fool ourselves. But it's also a slowly developing change that I feel about the same today as I did yesterday. But I don't feel the same as I did 5 years ago when I was sleeping much more.
Doctor, give us some expert tips to get a great night's sleep starting tonight.
So I think the first thing is you have to make the decision that sleep is indeed important for myself, my family, my employees, and you need to optimize your opportunity to get sleep. You know, don't work right up until bedtime. Get yourself some downtime. Electronics, there's a new discovery of a special cell in the retina. It's a non-image producing cell, but it reacts to blue light, and that makes sense. The sky is blue. We're hardwired to be alert during the day. So electronics are pretty heavy in the blue spectrum. So getting the electronics off and out of your face at least an hour before bedtime is recommended. If there's a clock on your bedside table, most people don't realize that it's normal to wake up during the night. Good sleepers awaken 5 to 11 times every night, though most of us are unaware of that because sleep has amnestic properties. You forget what happened right before you fall asleep. So if you lift your head, look around a dark room, put your head back down, you'll go right back to sleep. But if you lift your head and you see that clock and you say it's 3 o'clock, you calculate two numbers. How long have I been here? How much time do I have left? And both of those will be anxiety provoking. So keep the bedroom quiet, dark, and no electronics on during the night. I don't agree with all sleep hygiene rules. I mean, to me, they're just common sense. Like if you're having trouble sleeping, you probably shouldn't drink coffee right before bedtime. That makes sense to me, but it doesn't make sense to everyone. But they also say go to bed at the same time, get up at the same time. Of the two, I really feel getting up is much more important than when you go to bed. And the reason is when you get up, it's the light in the morning that resets your clock every day. Our clock tends to run a little long, about 24.2 hours. That means we have to reset it every day, and it's bright light that does that. That's also why shift workers never fully adapt to the night shift, because if they get off work and they see the sun, it just reset their clock again.
Do we know how many hours of sleep the average American gets and how much more they need? How bad is it out there?
It's pretty bad. The Center for Disease Control published a huge study. It's almost 450,000 people, and they stratified it by state and by gender and all kinds of different stratifications. But what was impressive about it is almost every state, about a third of the population, is getting less than 7 hours of sleep on a regular basis. And again, things like the DINGIS study suggest that anybody sleeping less than 7 hours routinely is going to start to accrue problems. And it could be mental problems, but it could be physical problems as well. There is a correlation between sleep time and weight. Sleep deprivation causes a change in two hormones in our brain, leptin and ghrelin, both of which are important for appetite and metabolism. When you're sleep deprived, your brain thinks you need more carbohydrates than you need. And diet and exercise are critically important, but without sleep, you're missing one third of the equation. And diet and exercise alone are not going to do it until you put sleep back into the equation.
So it sounds like 7 hours is your bare minimum.
The National Sleep Foundation just came up with their guidelines, and they're saying 7 hours is the bare minimum, yes. Now, there are natural short sleepers, but that is much less than 5% of the population. 95% of us need at least 7 hours or more.
Dr. W. David Brown from Children's Medical Center in Dallas, co-author of Sleeping Your Way to the Top, How to Get the Sleep You Need to Succeed. Dr. Brown, thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, and sleep well.
Still to come on Success Journal, a look at the future and why we should feel optimistic about what's ahead. And a man creates a doll for boys and earns himself a handsome figure. For you, the listeners of the Success Journal podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. There's a book I want to recommend to you. It could easily be called life-changing, yet it's been around for decades. And when I say it was written by Dale Carnegie, you'll probably assume I'm talking about How to Win Friends and Influence People, but that is not it. The book I think is much more powerful by Carnegie is How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. It's old school, but it's packed with brilliant, time-tested advice that will really be life-changing for you. The audiobook is unabridged, and it's narrated by a guy with an incredible voice, Andrew McMillan. He will keep you riveted to what he's saying. And you can get the audiobook, How to Stop Worrying and Start Living, or any other book you want, absolutely free for this trial offer. Just go to audibletrial.com/successjournal. That's audibletrial.com/successjournal. The rise of technology over the past 100 years has been astounding, but what's in store for us in the next 30 years? Our next guest has some answers. He's Kevin Kelly, author of The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. How about we turn to the internet as we begin here? as you said, it hasn't been around that long. What will the impact of the internet be in 20 or 30 years?
I think the best way to think about the internet in 20 years is to think of it less as a place that you go to and more as a presence. It'll be really kind of rife with a lot of artificial smartness and conversational bots, things that you can kind of talk to, ask questions for, interact with. And those bots will be watching what you do and trying to anticipate where you're going. So you can kind of imagine the internet as kind of like a GPS for your life, where you're going along and it's kind of looking ahead, kind of anticipating what you're going to be doing that day. And then if you change your mind, it says, oh, never mind, I'll have another packet for you. I'll do another route. I'll prepare other things ahead of you. And if you decide to change your mind again, it is phased by that, but it's having a conversation with you in a kind of a larger sense. That, I think, is one vision of this internet that we're going to. And the second one is to imagine it as not a place that we know things, which is what it is today, but a place that we experience. And the kind of internet of experiences. Let me say it that way.
Kevin, along with the internet and it becoming much more, I guess, pervasive, what about privacy and tracking? How are those going to change?
Well, there'll be a lot more of it. Let me put it that way.
A lot more tracking?
A lot more tracking, yes. And in fact, a lot of people are looking forward to the kind of these virtual reality worlds, but one of the things about them is that they're inherently made to track your movements, your activities. They're not really being recorded right now, but they're being captured, and that data in the future would be useful. So we're going into an area where there's more and more of our lives that we self-track. We track ourselves with the Fitbits. Our friends track us with tagging each other on our Facebooks. Companies track us, and the government is increasingly tracking us. All those things suggest that in 20 years from now, that huge parts of our lives will all be tracked in some capacity, and that's inevitable. What's not inevitable is what we do with it, how we can civilize that tracking in some ways, how we can make it much more symmetrical, tolerable, so that we can see who's tracking us, we can track them, we can hold them accountable, we can get some benefits for that tracking, which we don't really do right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we can make that increased tracking more civilized by choosing and making some political choices about the tracking, but I don't think we can stop the tracking.
One of the areas I guess you can explain or talk about are robots, and you're saying we shouldn't worry about robots taking away our jobs.
Well, robots are just AIs, artificial intelligences that have bodies, and some of those bots will be more software than hardware, but we'll be working with them. The important part about all this stuff about artificial smartness and artificial intelligence is that this kind of intelligence is different than human type of thinking. They think differently. Right now, your calculator is smarter than you are in arithmetic, and Google is smarter than you are in recall. Those are very specialized types of thinking, but human intelligence is really made up of hundreds of different modes or instruments of cognition, all thinking differently, deductive reasoning or inductive reasoning and perception. And so we're engineering these machines, our machines, to think differently than humans, in some cases to think better than we do in smaller dimensions. And that's the main use for them, is that they don't think like us. The reason why we want the AIs to drive our cars is because they're not driving like us, because they're not distracted, because they're focused on driving and they're optimized to drive well. That's their virtue, is that they don't drive like humans drive. And I think when we look at the jobs, most of the jobs that we have are really bundles of different tasks. So some of those tasks will be automated by the bots, robots and AIs, and they'll redefine some of the other ones that we're doing. I think a better image to have in your mind is to imagine us working with, alongside of, together with AIs and robots, rather than against them. That's much closer to where we're going.
Our guest is Kevin Kelly, author of The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Kevin, I really like that everything you've been talking about seems very, very optimistic. It's sort of the opposite of the way Hollywood movies seem to present the future. It's typically a dark kind of a scene. You're very positive about it.
I'm off-the-chart optimistic, and a lot of my optimism comes from history. Right now, there's sort of a pessimism in America that's actually not shared by the rest of the world. Places like Asia are incredibly optimistic about the future. But I think right now, there's a little bit of a spell of pessimism that doesn't match at all with the actual evidence, which is that our lives are getting better and have been getting better for hundreds of years and even in the last decade. Almost all the measurements that you would want, the evidence suggests it will continue in that same direction. And I think that the beauty of technology is that it keeps increasing our choices without taking away very many of the old ones. So if you want to have a life like the Amish where you don't use artificial intelligence, you don't have to. You can choose and arrange your life to be without it. Although most people probably will choose to have the AIs drive their cars.
If you were to advise a young person who may be listening right now as to the best place for them to focus their career, knowing what you know, what would you suggest?
I might do something very counterintuitive. I think that one of the things you want to learn, one of the skills you want to learn, I call them techno-literate skills, is the skill of learning how to learn. So if you're learning a computer language in school, it's going to be useless by the time you graduate. There'll be a whole new one. So when we were at Wired and we were hiring young people, we didn't hire them for the skills. We hired them for their aptitude and attitude. And then you could teach them later because whatever skills they had needed to be relearned. And we found experience a lot more useful than even educational level. The people that do the best have a much broader experience, learn some history, take an art class, learn some engineering, of course, but have the right attitude and aptitude is a lot more important than having the kind of fashionable skill.
Kevin Kelly, author of The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate the invitation to be on your show. Thank you.
How about a 60-second Success Journal story about a man who creates a doll for boys and earns himself a handsome figure? Stan was a marketer who loved to read. One night while skimming a magazine, Stan came upon a colorful photo of old army medals. The image gave him an idea that made him want to stand up and salute. As a kid, he loved playing imaginary soldier games, and he knew that Barbie dolls were big sellers. Maybe a soldier doll would have a fighting chance in the toy stores, too. But calling it a doll wouldn't be cool to boys. So Stan chose to call it an action figure instead. After months of research and testing, Stan's little army doll declared victory with toy buyers. You know the figure Stan Weston dreamed up long ago. He named it G.I. Joe. And it's still a bestseller. And now it's time for me to march on out of here. Thanks as always for listening. I'm Chris Whitting for Success Journal, wishing you a highly successful day.